more healthy. Radio Addiction starts now.
Power to the people!
The Laura Ingraham Show.
Jingle bell, jingle bell, jingle bell rock. Jingle bell time in jingle bell time. Dancing and prancing in Jingle Bell Square. In the frosty air.
Hello, America. This is Betsy McCoy in for Laura Ingraham, the voice of liberty, and this is your Christmas show. You can reach us at 855-40-LAURA, 855-40-LAURA. You can reach Laura at Ingraham Angle, and you can reach me at BetsyMcCoy.com. I hope you will. I've put together this special Christmas show for you. In fact, putting this show together is the most important project I've had all season. Aside from cooking for my three daughters and two beautiful little granddaughters, this is it for me, delivering this special package for you over the next 3 hours. And we've got some lineup. Larry Kudlow, Ambassador John Bolton, how about Carly Fiorina, Senator Rand Paul, and the inimitable Ann Coulter, and so much more. So I'm really glad you're going to sit down with me and enjoy some Christmas chat and some serious topics as well. I've got my Christmas Santa hat on, and riding in the cockpit seat is John Bennett with his Santa hat on. So join us for this real Christmas spirit. Our first guest is going to be the very, very special conservative thinker, supply-sider, Larry Kudlow. But before we get to that, I have a few headlines for you. Moments of silence don't work so well on the radio, but we can give a moment of heartfelt gratitude to Detective Joseph Lem, a former NYPD cop, who was killed this week serving his country in Afghanistan. When Lem was on the police force in New York City, he really spoke up against the cop haters who are constantly diminishing and criticizing our bravest, our finest. And then he went to serve in Afghanistan and gave his life there. So to his family, to all who will miss him, we want to say thank you, Joseph Lem, for serving us twice, once on the streets of New York and then again in the battlefields of Afghanistan. As Lem himself noted many times, appreciation for cops shouldn't be just when they give their lives in action on the streets. And we can say the same for the military. We appreciate them every single day of the year. Here's another headline. The next GOP debate is going to be a little smaller. Fox Business, which is hosting the debate, has announced that it's going to limit the debate field to six candidates. So far, it appears as if Donald Trump, Ted Cruz, Marco Rubio, Ben Carson, Jeb Bush, and Chris Christie will make the cut. So if you're a Rand Paul fan or a Carly Fiorina fan, for example, stick with us. We're going to have both of them on later in the show, and you'll get to hear them and ask a question. Just give us a call at 855-40-LAURA, 855-40-LAURA. Well, it seems as if there are two national political parties in the country now, the Scrooge Party and the Christmas Party. A new Pew poll, I know I can say that right if I practice, Pew, as in Pew Research Foundation, a new Pew poll found that only 32% of Democrats like to hear the phrase, Merry Christmas. They want to go with season's greetings instead. But let's not take the Christmas out of Christmas. And speaking of holidays, if you're looking forward to New Year's Eve already, you can toast in the new year with the Donald himself. He's going to be the featured guest on Fox News's All-American New Year's Eve coverage with Eric Bolling and Kimberly Guilfoyle. So if you're a big The Donald fan, get your champagne glass ready now. I happen to be a Rand Paul fan as well. And he's got something going that's really important to many of our listeners. He's pushing legislation that would restrict President Obama's ability to impose gun control regulations against the Second Amendment. In Rand Paul's words, in the United States, we don't have a king, but we do have a constitution, and we have a Second Amendment, and I will fight tooth and nail to protect it, he said. The legislation is being fast-tracked through the Senate, and we hope it will tie the president's hands when he tries to impose gun regulations without the consent of the governed. Here's another Scrooge story for you. On orders from the top Scrooge, the Ebenezer Scrooge currently occupying the White House, veterans' hospitals across the country are taking down signs that say Merry Christmas, prohibiting visitors from wishing the residents of the hospitals and the staff Merry Christmas, taking down any signs of the manger, anything that smacks of religion. The South Texas Veterans Healthcare System admitted they're stripping the place of anything that says Jesus Christ. And it's not the first hospital to actually scrub away the Christmas cheer. Salem, Virginia's Veterans Hospital did the same thing, even banning religious Christmas carols. Can't wait for 2016. It can't come soon enough. And our final headline, this one regards a couple, Joseph and Mary. They went to register in the town of Bethlehem, and they were expecting a child. And while they were there, the time came for the baby to be born. And she gave birth to her firstborn, a son. She wrapped him in clothes and placed him in a manger because there was no guest room available for them. And there were shepherds living out in the fields nearby, keeping watch over their flocks at night. An angel of the Lord appeared to them, and the glory of the Lord shone around them, and they were terrified. But the angel said to them, "Do not be afraid. I bring you good news. I bring you good news that will cause great joy for all the people. Today in the town of David, a Savior has been born to you. He is the Messiah, the Lord. This will be a sign to you. You will find a baby wrapped in clothes and lying in a manger." And suddenly a great company of the heavenly host appeared with the angel, praising God and saying, "Glory to God in the highest heaven, and on earth peace to those on whom his favor rests." And that's the biggest news of this season. Now I'm very excited to welcome our first guest, Larry Kudlow. He's a conservative. You won't mistake him for anything else. He's a supply-sider. He's a great American patriot. He's a well-known news commentator. He had his own show on CNBC, The Kudlow Report. And I hear he may be running for the United States Senate from Connecticut. Larry, on the phone?
Good morning, Betsy.
Oh, it is such a privilege to have you on. Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas to you. I'm glad you're putting Christmas back in Christmas.
Yeah, well,
very pleased to hear this.
If not now, when, right? I've got my Christmas hat on, and after the show, I'll go home and make some special dinners for my grandbabies. But
oh, good.
You have been making a lot of news lately. You've always been a pro-immigration advocate, and now you've taken a hard line in the other direction. Tell us about it.
Well, I think the first and major reason is war. I'm not sure the Obama administration understands that we are in a war with ISIS and related groups. I know they don't understand that Iran is our enemy, not our friend. So, you know, my take is right now, since FBI Director Jim Comey has said we can't really increase any visa waivers, because we don't know who the people are who might come over here. I think that includes people for any border, Betsy, any border, the eastern border, east coast border, the south, southern border, the northern border. I look at that. I know Comey. He's a very, very good cop. And I say, no more. Until this thing gets sorted out, until we figure out some information, some folders, some reliable stuff on these immigrants or, you know, people want visas or refugees.
Even brides, right?
Well, we can't do it. I mean,
right.
You hear these stories, you read these stories that ISIS is gaming the system, you know, using the refugee system, using the visa system to get their agents into the United States. Okay, fine. Close the borders. Real simple. My first and foremost issue is American security. I don't see American security. So I say all this stuff has to be put on, all the reforms have to be put on the back burner, and let's just try to lock down the borders as best we can. I'm sure you saw this recent story, this incredible story yesterday. Obama is allowing Iran, okay, our great friend Iran, more visa waivers.
Oh, yeah, this is just so
incredible.
Shocking. Right.
Incredible. Supposedly from the deal we made, the terrible deal we made, now John Kerry is giving Iran more than anybody knew and making nice with Iran. I don't know if Obama understands we are in a war, but you understand it.
Well, clearly he doesn't think we're in a war with Iran, and I'm so glad you raised that topic because that's how you first came into the horizon as a possible candidate for the United States Senate
right.
next year. You said to Richard Blumenthal that Iran hobnobber from Connecticut, I'm going to run against you if you vote for this deal, correct?
That is correct. It was a couple, 3 months ago. I was talking to my friend Peter Roskam, who is a congressman doing the whip count in the House, and I asked him about the Senate. What do you know? And we got to talking. I said, by the way, what about Blumenthal in Connecticut, my home state? And he said, well, as far as he knew, he was backing Obama on the Iran deal. And I kind of exploded and said, well, you know what? If this guy goes that way, if he votes for the Iran deal, I'm going to run against him. And it was kind of a semi-announcement.
I'm surprised he didn't get so scared at that point because you're so popular, so prominent.
Well, look, he started writing emails to his financial followers calling me all kinds of names, and apparently I got under his skin. I think he called me, let me see, Betsy, he called me a tool of Wall Street. I consort with billionaires.
I'm telling you, that's amazing coming out of his mouth with all this inherited wealth, right? The big gated house in Greenwich, Connecticut, and he's accusing you of consorting with billionaires.
First of all, I believe America should have as many billionaires as possible.
Amen.
And I think a rising tide should lift all boats, by the
right.
way. But you got a point there. It turns out with just a little bit of research, as in Google, his family owns the Empire State Building.
That is very funny.
I don't mean to laugh at that because I like the Empire State Building. But to have class warfare against me and then own the Empire State Building strikes me as a bit hilarious.
Well, we're going to be watching you, Larry, because you're going to be a fantastic candidate for the United States Senate and a great statesman. And thank you for joining us this morning, and Merry Christmas.
You too, Betsy. You too.
The Laura Ingraham Show.
Glad you stayed with me, Bubba. This is Betsy McCoy in for Laura Ingraham. This is your special Christmas show, a gift from me. We've got a fabulous lineup, and it's your healthy radio addiction. You can reach us at 855-40-LAURA, 855-40-LAURA. You can reach Laura at Ingraham Angle, and you can reach me at BetsyMcCoy.com. And on the line with us is one of the smartest women in politics. Some people call her a political diva, but she's really more than that. She is one of the most influential people in the conservative side of the political spectrum. Heather Higgins, also founder and CEO of the Independent Women's Forum. Hello, Heather.
Hello. I don't recognize myself. Thank you.
Yes, you do. I have to say, as an aside, since it's the Christmas season, she also gives a wonderful Christmas party for friends every year and makes all the food herself. It puts the rest of us to shame how much of this gorgeous cooking she does, turkeys and hams and all kinds of hors d'oeuvres. It's really spectacular. But we're on to talk about politics. And I have to tell you, Heather, I'm going to express the frustration felt by so many of us. We worked hard to elect Republicans, conservative Republicans, Tea Party Republicans, to the House and the Senate. And we look at this deal, this budget deal that just went down last week, and say, what did we work so hard for?
I know it's so frustrating. We look at this and we keep saying, we're spending so much and we want to go the other way. But I think realistically, until we have a president, that's very hard to execute on. And the challenges that we have also is manifold. You had Boehner crafting this budget agreement that before he left office that set the spending parameters.
Right, he gave away the store.
He did. But what Paul Ryan was left with was, how do you make the best out of that? And he had a further challenge of he had a strong conviction that, I mean, I know that there are conservatives who are fine with shutting down the government and believe that that's a viable strategy, but there are many other Republicans who are concerned that that means that you will wind up costing yourself votes, and their long-term game is to win the presidency and keep Senate seats as we go into 2016. Because if we don't win the presidency and we don't maintain a majority in the Senate, and even with a majority in the Senate, we will still need Democrat votes to accomplish repealing Obamacare and repealing so many other things that has been done by this administration during its tenure, then it's the game's up. You know, so a long game is, how do you get most people to vote for you? And avoiding shutting down the government and dramatic gestures like that that work really well for our base and alienate everybody else,
right,
is one of the strategies. And so the question was, how much could they accomplish? And the challenge here was, you had a lot of conservatives saying, on principle, and we admire their principle, that they were not going to vote for it. Well, that's essentially to vote with the Democrats, right? To say no to a Republican budget, which meant that Paul Ryan had to go and negotiate with Democrats because he didn't have enough Republican votes.
Right. And so that was really frustrating, to see funding for things like sanctuary cities, more refugees, more Obamacare giveaways. Very frustrating.
It is very frustrating. But it's also, remember, one of the virtues of a republic is that you can't just mandate something. You have
Heather,
to negotiate about it.
You keep working for us, okay?
Well, I'm going to try.
And Merry Christmas, one of the
Merry
great
Christmas.
Conservatives in America.
And
Heather
remember,
Higgins.
We got good things in this deal, too.
Well, that's true. We'll be back after the break. This is Betsy McCoy, your healthy radio addiction. La, 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 la. This is Betsy McCoy standing in for Laura Ingraham. This is your Christmas show, a gift from me to you. Merry, Merry Christmas. We've got a great lineup today, and our next guest is Ambassador John Bolton. He is former UN ambassador. He is a scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. I hope he will be the next Secretary of State for the United States, because he knows his stuff and he believes in liberty. Ambassador John Bolton, welcome.
Well, thank you, Betsy. Glad to be with you. Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas to you. National security is really taking center stage in this presidential race. Fortunately, that means that all Americans have to start thinking beyond our borders, how we're going to protect ourselves. And so it's very fortunate for us that we can ask you a couple of questions about things that are nagging all of us. Number one is, why are we going ahead with this Iranian deal? They seem to be breaking it left and right. They haven't even signed it. And yet we're sending over $100 billion in money to them.
Well, it's completely unjustifiable what the Obama administration is doing. You know, I've been saying while this deal was being negotiated, when they signed it, that it was the worst act of appeasement in American history. And the administration's course of conduct since they signed the deal in Vienna, unfortunately, has only confirmed that, as you indicate. This most recent effort by Secretary of State John Kerry to ease the concern of the Ayatollahs in Tehran about people getting visas to come into the United States even after they've been to visit Tehran. It's just one example after another, rockets being launched by the Iranians in violation of Security Council resolutions that are still outstanding. And let's be clear, the only purpose for the missile testing is to make the missiles for delivery vehicles for nuclear weapons. And, you know, we look at Syria now, we look at ISIS and the threat it poses in the United States and in Europe. But let's not forget, as big a threat as ISIS is, and it certainly is, Iran is on a path to nuclear weapons. And given that Iran, since 1979, when the Ayatollahs took over, has been the biggest state sponsor of terrorism, the fear I think we all have that nuclear weapons will come into the hands of terrorists is just growing day by day.
And those nuclear weapons will be pointed at Israel and at the United States.
No, exactly. And people say, oh, but, you know, the Iranians are Shia and ISIS and Al-Qaeda are Sunni. Let's never forget the famous observation in the Middle East, I against my brother and I against our cousin, all of us against the outsider. So Iran has been an equal opportunity state sponsor of terrorism, the Taliban in Afghanistan, Hamas in the Gaza Strip, as well as Hezbollah, as well as Shiite militia in Iraq. So I don't put it beyond the Ayatollahs, given their fanaticism and the militarization of their regime over the years, to be prepared at some point to put a nuclear weapon in the hands even of Sunni terrorists.
Is there anything we can do, we the American people, our representatives in Congress, to stop the transfer of this huge amount of money that Iran can use to buy bullets and missiles to kill our own military?
Well, you know, I'm afraid at this point it may be beyond the control of Congress, and it goes to show, I think, why congressional opposition to the deal was so inadequate, really so weak, that Obama was able to push it through. I'm afraid what it's going to require is a president who will take office in 2017 who will abrogate this deal, hopefully in his or her inaugural address. And to go back to the point you opened with which I think is completely correct, this is going to be a national security election. And the threat of nuclear proliferation, again, we're obviously concerned about San Bernardino and the terrorist attacks, but just imagine the terrorist with nuclear, chemical, or biological weapons.
Horrible. But by then, the $130 billion or so will have been transferred back to Iran. Am I correct?
I think that's largely correct. In fact, the Iranians, this is another test of the Obama administration. The Iranians would like to speed up the timetable in the Vienna deal. And from what I've seen, it looks like the Obama administration and the Europeans will go along with that. So that all those resources can be deployed to help out the Assad regime in Syria, to help out other terrorist groups around the world to conduct their nuclear program research. And also to help step up the Iranian economy and take advantage of the lifting of the sanctions.
So a nation, Iran, that was tottering on the brink of economic disaster will be fortified by this money.
Absolutely. This is a real case study in Barack Obama's giving up American positions of strength around the world. And it's happened not just with respect to Iran, but really dealing with the terrorists, dealing with Vladimir Putin's Russia, dealing with China and the South China Sea, positions that the United States has built up over years and decades, Obama's just been giving away. And I have to say, I'm very worried in the last year of his presidency that he's going to try and create his legacy, as we've seen, by closing Gitmo maybe even giving the entire facility back to Cuba. I mean, there's a long list of things I'm worried he's going to do that will leave a new president in 2017 in an even weaker position than we are today.
Well, you usually have the crystal ball. So what about Russia?
Well, I think that Putin sees in the Obama White House a real weak opponent, and he has taken advantage of that. I think he's outmaneuvering us right now in Syria, and I think that will continue. I think he's angling with the Europeans to get the sanctions imposed because of his belligerence in Ukraine lifted, and I think he's on the verge of getting that. And I think there's every reason to fear that in the next year he will try some provocation against one of the Baltic republics, Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, who, after all, are NATO members. And I think Putin, like Xi Jinping and China, like state sponsors of terrorism around the world and the terrorists themselves, they don't know who will win in November of next year, but they know who they've got in office until then. And that's one of the reasons why I'm worried that in the next year, not only will Obama be trying to create his legacy here, but our adversaries overseas will be trying to take advantage of his remaining time in office.
You bet. Putin's going to have his own legacy. Let me ask you this. Putin, it appears, would like to shatter NATO. And attacking a NATO country and then the U.S. not doing anything in response, wouldn't that be more or less the end of NATO?
Well, it would be an extraordinarily grave blow to NATO. And that's why I mentioned the three Baltic republics. They're small. They have substantial ethnic Russian populations. You know, if you were going to formulate incidents and controversies, it's just as easy, maybe even easier in those three countries than it has been in Ukraine. They're distant from other NATO territory. And so I think from Putin's point of view, this is almost a pass. He gets a free test. If by chance Obama responds vigorously and strongly, Putin can pull back. But if he doesn't, he keeps pressing ahead. And I think demonstrating that Russia can act against a NATO member on its periphery will chill the Eastern and Central Europeans. And it would be, I think, just extremely damaging to NATO solidarity.
Scary prospect. And yet, as we watch Obama, we can tell that he would not act in an aggressive fashion to defend that area of the world.
No, almost certainly not. And that's, you know, that's the calculus I'm sure Putin is going through. How much of a risk should he take? How much does he think he can get away with? It's not really what the American response will be. It's that he doesn't want to overestimate what his capabilities are. And that's really frightening. And I think other countries like China around the world are watching this. They see this American weakness, and they're going to try and take advantage of it, too. That's why it just underlines why, although we've got a lot of other issues, including an anemic economy and the need to repeal Obamacare, it's why voters have to look at the people aspiring to the presidency and really ask themselves first, can this person sit behind the big desk in the Oval Office and make the hard choices that keep the country safe?
And avoid some of the charades. Speaking of charades, let's go to the Paris Climate Conference. The president made a big deal out of this as the so many of cities in the world are quaking with fear over these ISIS terrorists. The president attends this climate conference and says that this will really show the terrorists who's in charge. What do you think is going to happen to this climate, quote, deal?
Well, the president is living in fantasy land if he thinks that anything that they did in Paris is going to really affect the international environment. The fact is that all of the pledges that are contained in the heart of the deal itself are national targets, which the nations basically are saying, this is what we'd like to do over the next 30 years. I mean, it really, it's blue smoke and mirrors. Mm-hmm. The whole thing is basically a propaganda exercise. The advocates of these policies knew they failed in Copenhagen near the beginning of Obama's term. So they were going to declare victory no matter what happened in Paris. I think a Republican presidential candidate who wins in November should abrogate the Vienna deal on Iran's nuclear weapons program first and say the United States has no intention of complying with this Paris deal second.
Two good points. I hope you'll be the next Secretary of State.
Well, thank you so much.
Now, but just envisioning a Republican president, what can he do, what can he or she do to stop the movement within the United States, fueled by the Democrats, to shut down our coal industry? And I'm raising this issue because, of course, this climate conference is a lot of propaganda that is brought home by the Democrats to try to persuade members of Congress to shut down our fossil fuel industry.
Yeah, I think that that since most of what Obama has done, he's done under the guise of authority delegated by Congress to the Environmental Protection Agency and the Department of the Interior and other parts of the executive branch of the government. So a new president, I think, can reverse almost all of it very quickly with new appointments and repealing some of the directives and executive orders that Obama has put in place. You know, we've done enormous work over several decades to clean up the consumption of coal, to reduce pollutants, and more can be done. We've got natural gas. It's just that the Obama administration lives this ideological fantasy that alternative sources of energy can be made to take up the burden that coal and oil and other carbon-based fuels have borne for so many years. You know, I'm not opposed to these others. If they can pass a market test, by all means, let's use them. But it's not it, what they're doing is not economically based. It's almost a theology about what they think global warming is. And I think for an enterprising Republican nominee next year, you know, there are a lot of union members and people whose jobs depend on a robust industrial sector that ought to be attracted to a Republican Party that talks about jobs and growth and not the austerity of the Obama approach to carbon-based fuels.
That's right. It appears as if the Democratic Party is tilting at windmills, so to speak.
Building them and then tilting at them, exactly.
Exactly. So, but what about the countries that are less developed? They what was their role at this conference?
Well, this is the other side of the coin and a very important one. The countries like India and China that are very heavily dependent on carbon-based fuels have made commitments that that got them sufficient publicity to get through the journalistic frenzy in Paris, but they're not serious about reducing carbon emissions. I mean, what the amazing thing is that Europe and the United States could meet the targets that Obama and the Western European leaders have set, and it would have no material effect on aggregate carbon emissions worldwide. We'd be restraining our own economies to no advantage, effectively, on the environmental front, if you believe all these theories about anthropogenic global warming. So this was the problem with Kyoto back in the 1990s. It was the reason they couldn't reach agreement in Copenhagen 6 years ago. And it shows why this Paris Agreement really is blue smoke and mirrors. The whole thing is a charade to show that the leaders were able to do something successful, which it reads well for the in the press for a few days, but has no lasting impact.
Well, Ambassador, on behalf of all Americans who are so grateful for your leadership, your insights, your intelligence on these issues, Merry Christmas.
Thank you so much. Happy New Year, Betsy.
Yes, thank you so much for joining us. This is Betsy McCoy standing in for Laura Ingraham. This is your Healthy Radio Addiction. We'll be back after the break. Steve King, Carly Fiorina, Rand Paul, and so much more. My Christmas present to you.
The Laura Ingraham Show.
Merry Christmas! This is Betsy McCoy standing in for Laura Ingraham, and this is a gift from me to you, a special Christmas show. You can reach us at 855-40-LAURA. You can tweet Laura at Ingraham Angle and reach me at BetsyMcCoy.com. And we have some callers on the line. Steve?
Hello, how are you?
Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas to you, too.
So what's on your mind, Steve?
Well, you know, I think I speak for a vast majority of American people when I say that when it comes to the Republican Party, the thing I've noticed is that I think it's just such a shame how the Democrats are just sitting idly back with a bag of popcorn and just watching the, you know, the Republican Party just tear itself up from the inside out.
Right.
You know, in the debates, it does, you know, in the debates, it does the same thing.
I so agree with you.
You know, they all
you.
Fight against each other instead of, and, you know, instead of uniting like they should, you know, and the one thing that I love is how Donald Trump just comes off the cuff.
Yeah. Me too. I like that a lot. And, you know, we don't want that circular firing squad. Steve? Oh, okay. You know, I think most of people listening agree with Steve that we're tired of the Republicans running ads against one another. We're all on the side of liberty, and whoever is chosen is it.
Radio addiction starts now.
Power to the people!
The Laura Ingraham Show.
Merry Christmas! This is Betsy McCoy in for Laura Ingraham, and this is my special Christmas present to you. I've got my Santa hat on and a great lineup for you in this hour, starting with Congressman Steve King, then Carly Fiorina and Rand Paul. You can reach us at 855-40-LAURA, 855-40-LAURA. You can tweet Laura at Ingraham Angle and email me at BetsyMcCoy.com. On the line is the most principled conservative in the United States House of Representatives, Congressman Steve King from Iowa. Congressman King, welcome.
Well, thanks a lot for having me on, and I'm just trying to imagine what you look like sitting there in the studio with your Santa hat.
Well, first of all, I'm standing. I always do. I like it better. But I'm pretty happy with my Santa hat on, and I know that you have a lot of faith and share my joy in Christmas.
I absolutely do, and I'm starting to be swept up in this Christmas spirit, even though we have a heat wave that's coming across America for this period of time. But I think that you should tweet a picture of yourself out there standing at the microphone in that Santa hat. I'd call that a keeper before I even see it.
Thank you. Well, speaking of keepers, there are a few things we'd rather not keep. Harry Reid's been spiking the ball about that deal worked out in Congress last week, $1.1 trillion spending bill. What's your view?
Well, I'm trying to figure out what it is the Democrats gave up. And, you know, I introduced nine amendments into the omnibus spending bill, and I brought them in chronological order, starting with eight of them were defund amendments. Defund Obamacare, defund the president's unconstitutional executive amnesties, all of them, and on down the line, defund Planned Parenthood, defund the refugee resettlement program, and then at the end also then to strike out the multiplier for the H-2B visas that they slipped in there in the last minute. Those were I had a lot of things that I thought were important for us to take a stand on. We take an oath to support and defend the Constitution of the United States, and if we're going to abdicate our responsibility to use the power of the purse to control a president who is, I think, out of control, and hand him the spending authority for the full fiscal year so there's no check on the president's actions between now and September 30th, I think we're in for a rough ride because of that, Betsy.
That's right. I looked at this bill, and I found it funds sanctuary cities. How could they possibly do that after the murder of Kate Steinle?
I cannot answer how they can do that. That was one of my amendments as well, to defund the sanctuary cities and all the sanctuary jurisdictions in the country. And in each one of these were amendments that I had had brought along the way that in different appropriations bills, and generally succeeded in getting them passed on the floor of the House. But here's what has happened. I mean, some of this is the legacy of John Boehner, and you know, he had it goes clear back to November 7th of 2010, the day after the election where the House majority was taken back over. We had 87 freshman Republicans on their way in, and I'm saying, as you were saying at the time as well, and we were saying together, defund Obamacare. And John Boehner was saying there will be no government shutdown, which meant we're going to fund whatever the president demands, or otherwise he will veto it and there will be a government shutdown. And so that legacy proceeded all the way through John Boehner's speakership, and this omnibus spending bill was the last of the piles of mess that was created by that rationale. I hope it's not started up again by Paul Ryan. He more or less got served up that sandwich, as he described it, and then John Boehner would have described it not quite as delicately as Paul Ryan did. So that's where we are. They're afraid of a government shutdown. They're afraid to say no to the president. If the president says, I will shut the entire government down, if you don't give me $500 million for Planned Parenthood specifically, for example, Sanctuary Cities is another, and if you don't do that, the president said he would shut the government down, and he would blame it on House Republicans and probably Senate Republicans. We weren't prepared to make that argument. It needed to be made 2 and 3 and 4 months ago so the American people knew what it really was. John Boehner would never make that argument, and I'm still waiting for Paul Ryan to make it. I hope he starts making it in this new term.
I hope so, too. The fact is that most Americans who want to see a smaller government and more safety, they look at this bill, which is now law, and they say, wait a second, why is it that Republicans have to control all three branches, House, Senate, and the White House, before we can control the spending? It's the House that is supposed to have the power of the purse.
Well, it is, and our founding fathers gave the power of initiating the spending to the House of Representatives, and along with that went an obligation to run for re-election every 2 years so that we would be the quick response team to bring a government back into control that wasn't responsive to the will of the people. And they didn't anticipate a number of things. Here's if I go to a little broader in this, the three branches of government, there's a static balance between the three. They are not three co-equal branches. The judicial branch of government is designed to be the weakest of the three, yet they have claimed authority that goes beyond that imagined by our founding fathers. The executive branch was to be under the control of the legislature. They wanted the people running this country, not an autocrat sitting in the White House. And so they expected that these divisions between the branches of government, because you can never write a constitution where the lines of authority between the three branches would be completely precise and that there wouldn't be gray area. Of course, there's some gray area. They anticipated that. But they believed that each branch of government would jealously protect the authority granted to it within the Constitution by the people.
Mm-hmm.
And that jealous protection of power then but needs to be exercised by the House of Representatives, and it's not being, and that's the heart of our problem right now.
That is, and Congressman, here's what the frustration most of us feel, which is we feel as if we're getting bamboozled, we're getting railroaded, because the members of Congress on the Republican side say, well, we're going to be blamed for a shutdown. Well, that would always be true unless we control the White House and both houses of Congress. And how often is that possible? All those voters who went to the polls and elected Republican senators and Republican House members felt that we would get something back for that, more control over our government.
Well, Betsy, you know, we had a government shutdown in October of 2013. That went
big
on
deal
for about 17 days. Well, actually, it was. 9 new freshman Republicans came into the United States Senate,
mm-hmm.
and we picked up some seats in the House. And so the people said, the people said, we like this. Congress is starting to assert itself. And then, so once that wave comes in, then you have the establishment wing of the party. Then Speaker Boehner, probably the lead voice in this, saying, well, you know, we've saved the conservatives from themselves, and we're still able to pick up 9 seats in the Senate and
right.
the extra seats in the House. They completely misinterpreted the message from the people and the public, and they started the capitulation to the White House all over again.
Well, and this seniority system seems to be really defying the popular will. When we elect newcomers to the House who reflect our zeal in controlling government and reducing the spending and increasing our national security, what happens to them? They get told to sit down and vote the way the speaker tells them to vote because they don't have seniority. So seniority is really taking our representation away from us.
Well, some of the seniority process works in just that fashion. And some of that, the way it was exerted by Speaker Boehner, what didn't discriminate by seniority, it discriminated by ideology.
Mm-hmm.
And you saw that there were four freshmen from that class that were removed from their committees because they didn't vote the way they were instructed to vote.
Yeah.
And, those folks are all friends of mine. And I'm proud of them for them holding their ground like that. Everyone that takes that oath should be able to do that without any hesitation, without blinking. It should be, these are my convictions. My vote will go up with my convictions. I'll answer to my constituents, but I'm not going to answer to the leadership. And so, but you still need to be a team player. And that means that the legislation needs to be worked out so that it does earn the support of the majority of the majority and the majority of the House of Representatives itself. And often that started out with the negotiations between the Republican and then John Boehner leadership and Nancy Pelosi. And once they got their votes pulled together, then they would serve that up and say, okay, here it is. Now you have to vote for it. And we can't change it. We can't amend it because that would break our deal with the Democrats.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if you start this legislation out and you bring it through the hearing process, subcommittee, committee to the floor, and you allow members to bring their amendments, then the reflection of the will of the people of America can emerge in the thing we call regular order. And we have
That's not right. Had
that for a while.
We don't like bosses in Congress. That's the bottom line there. I have to ask you about something else that you did that is really important, and that is the issue of birthright citizenship.
Well, yes, I've introduced for the last several Congresses legislation that puts an end to the automatic citizenship or birthright citizenship that has been conferred not by law, by practice, by force of habit, and by executive agreement, apparently. And in that, the Constitution says that all persons born in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof are American citizens. And there's a fairly long scholarship and history on that.
Right.
And it often gets warped by the left. But it's this, that babies born to illegal aliens in the United States don't have a statutory or constitutional guarantee of automatic citizenship. But we've got birth tourism taking place. Tens of thousands come into the United States every year.
Especially in the southern border. Right. I am so glad you have raised this issue because Americans are under the misimpression that this is guaranteed by the Constitution, and it is not. Let me say this for you. I hope you'll come back on next week on the 29th with I'm guest hosting again because you are so knowledgeable. And in the meantime, Congressman King, Merry Christmas.
Betsy and everybody listening, Merry Christmas, and I'll see you before the Happy New Year, but I wish that on you as well.
Thank you so much. This is Betsy McCoy standing in for Laura Ingraham. This is your healthy radio addiction and a Christmas special for you. Next up, Carly Fiorina, Hillary Clinton's worst nightmare.
The Laura Ingraham Show.
Welcome back, Bubbleheads. Betsy McCoy, so glad you're with me, standing in for Laura Ingraham. And this is your Christmas show, a special present from me to you. And on the line is one of the stars of American politics, Carly Fiorina, a woman who rose from secretary to CEO and is now running for president of the United States. Welcome, Ms. Fiorina.
Betsy, how are you? Good morning, good day, and Merry Christmas, and Merry please call me
Christmas.
Carly.
Okay, Merry, Merry Christmas. I can't tell you how thrilled I am to have you on the show because you are Hillary Clinton's worst nightmare. Here is a woman who is talking constantly about shattering glass ceilings, but in fact, everywhere she's gotten riding on her husband's sleazy coattails. She's not self-made at all, and you truly are. So tell us the one thing that voters need to know about you.
First, Betsy, I can beat Hillary Clinton. I can beat Hillary Clinton, and that's important.
Oh, yeah.
Because unless we beat her, we cannot take our country back. And we cannot keep our nation safe.
Mm-hmm.
I can beat her because I will force her to fight on ground she doesn't want to fight on. The ground she does not want to fight on is her track record or lack thereof. She
and
doesn't
woman
want
to
talk
to
about
woman.
Her lies. That's right. She doesn't want to talk about her lies about Benghazi or her email or her service. She doesn't want to talk about the fact that she's gotten every foreign policy challenge wrong. No. What she wants to talk about is the historic nature of her candidacy. She wants to talk about the war on women. She wants to talk about all these things except who she really is and what she's really done. Look, I will never ask for people's support because I'm a woman, although I am very proud to be one. I will ask for people's support because I'm the most qualified candidate to do this job and to win this job, but I am the only candidate who can force Hillary Clinton to fight on the ground she doesn't want to fight on. And when I force her to do that, I will win. In your listeners' heart of hearts, they cannot wait to see that debate between Hillary Clinton and Carly Fiorina, and that's because they know what's going to happen. I'll beat her.
I certainly would like to see that debate, believe me. Now, Hillary Clinton went to Minneapolis last week and made an announcement about how important it is for Americans to work with the Muslim American community, that they are our friends, that this is a kind-hearted group, and that they will help us defeat terrorism. To me, appearing in Little Mogadishu, which is hardly Little Italy or Chinatown, it's a dangerous place, appearing in Little Mogadishu and saying, look at this wonderful community of Somali refugees, was kind of like announcing your diet plans at a Baskin Robbins. It was just such a...
Well, that's a good analogy. Yes, it would have been far better had she gone to San Bernardino to grieve mm-hmm. with that community and told us her plan for keeping us safe. But, of course, she doesn't have a plan to keep us safe.
No.
She's gotten literally everything wrong in foreign policy. I mean, I keep saying that, but ISIS is now in Libya. Thanks to her failed policy. She is the one who said, now we're where we need to be because the UN has passed a resolution to get rid of Bashar al-Assad. She forgets that she is the one who called Bashar al-Assad a positive reformer and opened an American embassy. She forgets that she is the one who declared victory in Iraq and cheered when Obama withdrew every single troop, leaving ISIS vast swaths of territory. And it is she who, while San Bernardino is practically still going on, she's talking about climate change and gun control. This is dangerous, and it's delusional. And that is why she has to be beaten.
No one speaks more clearly about Hillary Clinton's flaws and past mistakes than you do. Now, moving to the domestic front, identify the worst thing she's done.
Well, she has no idea how to create jobs. She has no idea how to preserve jobs because she's never done that in her life. So every single policy that she proposes destroys more jobs. We have to put people back to work. She won't. Look, let me just say, I am the lump of coal in Hillary Clinton's stocking. She
I
is
love
the
that.
One person she hopes that she will not have to face in a general election.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me just say this. We love watching you debate. You do a superb job up on that stage, and you are Hillary Clinton's worst nightmare. Thank you so much for joining us, Carly Fiorina, and Merry Christmas.
Betsy, Merry Christmas to you as well. Thank you so much for having me.
You're welcome. This is Betsy McCoy standing in for Laura Ingraham. This is your healthy radio addiction.
for Christmas. Just you wait and see.
Glad you stayed with me, Bubba. This is Betsy McCoy in for Laura Ingram, and we are home for Christmas. This is your Christmas show. I've put it together as a special present to you. You can reach us at 855-40-LAURA. You can tweet Laura at Ingram Angle, and you can reach me at BetsyMcCoy.com. And we've got a caller now on line two. Jack?
Yes, I'm here.
Merry Betsy. Christmas, Jack.
Merry Christmas, Betsy. I'm calling from Spring Hill, Florida. I'm a senior citizen. I got here via Illinois, and when I crossed the Georgia-Florida line, I knelt down and kissed the Florida ground, let me tell you.
I love it, too. No income tax. It's not just the weather that's good there, right?
I fell in love with Florida when I was a young sailor stationed on your coast over in Jacksonville, Florida, at Mayport. I was on a U.S. destroyer, USS Power, DD-839. But anyhow, I am a full-fledged Floridian. My question is this, Betsy. I listen to this show every day on my computer because your signal doesn't come this far. But how much evidence does the Attorney General, Loretta Lynch, need to prosecute Hillary Clinton for the use of her private server, sending upwards of 1,000 secret or confidential government information?
Well, the problem is it's not just a matter of evidence. There's a lot of evidence there, but it's the political will that's lacking. And the concept that Loretta Lynch, the Justice Department belonging to President Obama, is going to prosecute Hillary Clinton, I'm telling you, that's not likely.
How do we go about it? Because she's thumbing her nose at all the Republicans, first of all, and all us citizens out here that do vote. I happen to be a not registered Republican, but I do vote Republican, and we need a Republican in the White House, that's for sure.
That's for sure.
But anyhow, I wish I could write a I wish if I was able, I would put up a brief if I could, but I can't. I'm not an attorney, and I'd go after her.
Right. Well, many of us feel that way, and we are horrified at her lies and her very irresponsible and dangerous use of that private email. Thank you for calling, and Merry Christmas.
Betcha. Merry Christmas to you,
Merry,
Betsy.
Merry Christmas. And now we have Senator Rand Paul on the line. It's a privilege to have him on the line. Of all the members of the United States Senate, he is one of the most knowledgeable on foreign policy, so we get to dive right into that. Thank you, Senator Paul, for joining us.
Thanks, Betsy, for having me.
You're quite welcome. So I want to get right to it. Your concept of closing off incoming travel from high-risk countries, tell us about it.
Well, you know, in 2013, when, you know, Marco Rubio and Schumer had their immigration bill come up, I had this similar kind of concept. I was worried about refugees coming into the country and attacking us because in my hometown of Bowling Green, two Iraqi refugees came posing as refugees and then tried to buy Stinger missiles. Then we found out that one of their fingerprints was in the database and nobody bothered to look. And so my problem, and that's why I introduced this as far back as 2013, I said, we've got to have better scrutiny. We cannot just let people come in the front door to attack us. But unfortunately, Rubio and Schumer and all the others ganged up and said they wouldn't have any conservative amendments or allow them, and they've defeated my amendment. So then about a week ago or a couple weeks ago, I did the same thing. And what I said in my amendment is that there's about 34 countries that have significant radical Islamic movements in their midst, is that we need more scrutiny. And, you know, I'm all for legitimate businessmen and women being able to travel, but we ought to have a background check. I think even in Europe, they ought to go through a background check. We have something called global entry where everybody has a background check, and I'm all for having everybody go through that so we know who's coming to visit.
What I like particularly about your proposal is nobody on the left or anyone else in the country can label it as racist or anti-Muslim. This is a matter of identifying high-risk countries like Afghanistan, Pakistan, Somalia, Iraq, where we know that these terrorists are going to infiltrate the refugees coming in and also anyone trying to get a visa.
Well, when you look at the recent tragedy in Paris, all of the attackers were French citizens. You don't have to have any kind of visa. You can come over here for 90 days with no visa. In fact, on 9/11, the one hijacker we caught before 9/11 was a French citizen who came over here on the visa waiver status. That's 15 years ago, and we still haven't done anything about it. And this has been my complaint all along. After 9/11, no one was fired. We didn't go to the root cause, which was people coming in here legally. All of the 9/11 hijackers came in here legally, and we have done nothing to make it, you know, have more of a background check or more vetting or screening before people come in. And it's, we spent trillions of dollars and often have invaded Americans' privacy, but we're doing nothing to try to slow down the people coming in and make sure not they're not coming here to attack us.
Well, and last week, Hillary Clinton went out to Minneapolis and held a press conference among a group of Somali refugees. It's a little area of Minneapolis called Little Mogadishu. And as I mentioned to Carly Fiorina earlier, she's claiming that this is the place to stop radical terrorism, that the people of Little Mogadishu can help. And I said, that's like holding a press conference at Baskin-Robbins to announce your weight loss plans. So my question to you is, why are we allowing these refugees to be settled in large groups in places like Little Mogadishu from countries like Somalia, where we know there's a significant radical Muslim population?
And the other question is, you know, we have a lot of poor people in our country. And so we're resettling people. And the one thing about the refugee program is everyone is automatically put in government housing. Everyone is automatically given Medicaid.
Welfare.
And put on public assistance.
Yep.
Absolutely. It's the only visa category where you're not only eligible, everyone is encouraged to be on welfare. And this is a real problem I have because, you know, charity is when you give your own money. Mm-hmm. My church here in town, we've supported refugees coming, and that's one thing. But it's another to give someone else's money, particularly when there is no money to give. You know, we're borrowing $1 million a minute, and so we're borrowing money from China to then give to refugees. And then we're not even vetting who's coming here, and it's a significant percentage, maybe enough so that it's a danger, are coming here with other intentions to attack us.
Now, what, since the Democratic opponent is likely to be Hillary Clinton, what can you point to in her record as Secretary of State that makes her particularly responsible for the dangers we now face regarding these refugees and inadequacy of our visa screening?
I think the one thing you want in a commander-in-chief is someone who will defend the country. That means defending the border, but it also means that you have to defend our embassies overseas. And I think Benghazi and her reaction to Benghazi really should preclude her from being considered. And I say that not because of the decisions she made that night, but because of the decisions for 9 months in advance when they were begging for security and she kept bringing all of the security home until in the very end the ambassador was essentially protected by about five or six Americans and supposedly some kind of militia or some kind of local jihadist group. And they were left to die over there. And I think that should never happen to Americans anywhere around the world. And I think that should preclude Hillary Clinton really from even being considered.
Well, I so agree, obviously. Unfortunately, there hasn't been enough in the mainstream news about it. She's not asked that in the debates because networks are in the pockets of the Democratic Party, and so we don't hear enough about that.
Well, that's why we need a nominee who will challenge her. Part of the problem, I thought, in the last debates, where I think Romney did well in the first debate, but in the second debate on foreign policy, he appeared to agree too much with President Obama, and I don't think he was strong enough. And really, that was after Benghazi.
Yes.
They should have really gone after him on the Benghazi tragedy, and I don't think we were aggressive enough to beat the Clintons. The Clintons are ruthless. I think they're often dishonest. And it's going to take a nominee who's not afraid to mix it up with the Clintons.
Only often?
Now, I was trying to be nice, Betsy.
Now, let me ask you one more thing, because there's been big news in Washington last week, this $1.1 trillion budget. And I know that you're a sensible, very sensible person. What's your take on this?
It's a terrible, awful, no good way to run your government. 2,242 pages. Nobody read it. It continues the tradition that's been going on in Washington now for years of borrowing $1 million a minute. And the interesting thing is, this is not just the fault of Democrats. In fact, really, it's the fault of both parties. And in fact, some of the loudest voices in Washington for increasing spending have really been coming from the right. They think they don't get enough money for military, so they make a deal with the liberal Democrats and they say, look, we'll give you more money for welfare if you give us more money for the military. And that busts the budget caps, and that really the deficit problem, it's the fault of both parties.
Yes.
And until we recognize that, I don't think we have a chance of ever balancing our budget. And that's the point I keep making in the debates, is that there are very few fiscal conservatives in that debate and very few fiscal conservatives, unfortunately, in Washington.
Right. But then you hear Marco Rubio or Carly Fiorina quite legitimately recite the shortcomings of our current defense status, the age of our Navy, the inadequacies of our Air Force. So where would you take the money? In other words, how would you solve that problem? We need a very strong military now, peace through strength, and yet we don't have it. And that's why so many Republicans got sandbagged into increasing domestic spending in order to get more military spending.
Yeah, you know, I'm a big fan of John Lehman, who was the youngest Secretary of the Navy under Reagan.
Mm-hmm.
And he believed in a strong Navy, still believes in a Navy that has more ships than we have now. But when you ask him how he would pay for it, he says he'd get rid of the bloated bureaucracy in the Pentagon. When he was Secretary of the Navy, there were like 7 joint task forces. There's 250 now. You can't move around the Pentagon without running into a general or an admiral. So we've become bloated, and we're not making wise decisions. We spend $600 billion on our military. That's a 50% increase in real dollars since 9/11. We spend more on our military than the next 10 countries combined. Add China to Russia plus 8 countries, and you get to our budget. So having more money spent is sort of the liberal concept of throw more money at a problem and it'll go away. I think we need to spend the money more wisely, and I think we have to discuss and debate whether or not regime change is a good idea. You know, Rubio and Clinton and Bush, they want regime change in the Middle East. But if you knock out Assad, my fear is that ISIS will grow stronger and that ISIS will be in charge of all of Syria. So really, regime change has not helped us. This is the biggest debate we ought to have in our country and in the party, is whether regime change has made us safer or made us less safe. My argument is, ISIS has gotten stronger as we toppled Gaddafi and as we push back ISIS and as we toppled Hussein, radical Islam has grown stronger.
You have made that point so effectively in the last debate. It was really quite impressive. So let's just, in wrapping up, let's make it clear then that one of the big problems is too much of the defense budget is being spent on people who aren't in uniform. They're occupying this huge bureaucracy in Washington.
Well, we also spend it on green programs. We spent $43 million in Afghanistan on a natural gas station. First, that's none of our business to build gas stations in Afghanistan. Second,
right.
They don't even have cars, much less cars that burn natural gas. But that's where your money's being wasted. We've been hijacked by these people who want to show how green they are. That has nothing to do with national defense. So we got to spend it more wisely. But the bottom line is, you can't be conservative if you're for unlimited spending for anything.
What's your strategy to get more points and be in the next debate? Because everybody really likes hearing your discussions, your viewpoint, your very informed viewpoint.
I think the debates need to be based on who's included should be polling, but also fundraising and also paid staff. You know, we have 100 paid staff in Iowa and New Hampshire. We have 800 precinct captains in Iowa. We have 99 county chairmen. We have every county occupied in New Hampshire as well. So I think we ought to get some credit for organizational ability, money raised, and other things. The polls are so inaccurate. They're going up and down 20 points over a several-week period for different candidates. I think it's a mistake if they try to exclude someone like me from the stage, and we're going to fight to make sure that doesn't happen.
That's great. And we're going to look for you to perform very well in that Iowa caucus, because it's all about organization.
Yep. And people are going to be surprised, because the polls that are coming out showing Donald Trump leading, I really think that ultimately a lot of those people being polled are not voters. Only about 10% of people show up for polling. So you better really have a good team on the ground to get people out to vote. And that's what we have.
Well, please check in with us again in another week or two. We're watching you carefully, Senator Rand Paul. And Merry Christmas.
Thanks, Betsy. Thank you. Merry Christmas to you.
Merry Christmas. That was Senator Rand Paul, and he's tipping us off to expect big things in Iowa because of his organization. This is Betsy McCoy standing in for Laura Ingram, your healthy radio addiction.
The Laura Ingram Show.
Christmas, America. This is Betsy McCoy standing in for Laura Ingram, and this is my special Christmas gift to you, a show with a all-star lineup. Right after the top of the hour, we'll be talking with Ann Coulter. But right now, we've got callers on the line. Larry on line six.
Hello.
Hi, Larry. Merry Christmas.
Hey, Merry Christmas to you. You know, I appreciate some of the good that some of our representatives do, like Stephen King, the earlier guest, and maybe Louie Gohmert of Texas, and right
here in South
Carolina.
Who will be on later, by the way. Yep.
Yeah, but there's two facts that I would like to just throw out there. Fact number one is that the Constitution of the United States puts the responsibility squarely and only on the shoulders of those 435 House members to protect us from corrupt officials.
That's right.
And fact number two is not one single House member of either party has started impeachment proceedings against any official that is engaged in treasonous. And
good point, Larry. This is Betsy McCoy standing in for Laura Ingram. This is your healthy radio addiction. We'll be back after the break with the all-star conservative in the nation, Ann Coulter.
Radio addiction starts now.
Power to the people!
The Laura Ingram Show.
Merry Christmas, baby. You sure to treat me nice.
Oh, Merry Christmas, America. This is Betsy McCoy standing in for Laura Ingram, and this is your special Christmas show, a gift from me to you. And the biggest gift of all now on the line is America's favorite conservative, Ann Coulter, author of, get this, 11 New York Times bestsellers. You see her on Hannity, but right now you can hear her right here on the Laura Ingram Show and ask her a question, 855-40-LAURA. Thank you, Ann, for joining us.
Sure. Great to be here, Betsy.
Merry Christmas. Okay, let's get right to it. You wrote a really interesting piece calling on all the other candidates to drop out so Donald Trump, the Donald, can be our candidate. Otherwise, America is going to turn into Uganda. Tell us what you meant.
Well, it's the theme of my massive best-selling book that's influenced Donald Trump, Adios America, the Left's Plan to Turn Our Country into a Third World Hellhole. And if we just continue the immigration policy we have, I mean, it could be too late already. It may be Democrats just won. They've changed the demographics enough that no Republican can win. The entire country's gone the way of California. But I'd at least like to know that so we can stop bothering, you know, like you to write important books on what's wrong with Obamacare and how to fix health care in America. You know, that's one thing if you're speaking to an American audience, but the left has been bringing in about 2 million a year immigrants from mostly dysfunctional third world cultures who don't speak English, come and immediately go on welfare, and are voting 8-2 for the Democrats. Post-1970 immigrants, only 20% vote for the Republicans. I don't know if you've noticed this, but an enormous number of these unaccompanied children camps are being put in crucial states that the Democrats need to turn.
Like Texas, right?
Yeah, huge numbers. So, you know, once Texas is gone, okay, well, that's it. Thanks, Paul Ryan and Marco Rubio and the RNC. You've really been keeping your eye on the ball here. And that's speaking just as a partisan Republican. But I'm the theme of my book. That's only comes up at the end. And is the change in the culture. I mean, we suddenly have a lot of my book is about crime and the unique and often shocking crimes being foisted on Americans, which both the government and the media carefully hide from us, lie to us about. You can find out, you know, all kinds of details from the U.S. Census, which I came across by accident. I was doing such broad searches to find out how many immigrants were in the our criminal justice system. You know, how many bathtubs have mold in America? How many homes have broken or missing stair railings? But you can't find out how many people our government, through a government policy, has brought to America are sitting in prison or jail.
Well, tell us more about this. Tell us how many of these prison cells are filled with immigrants from third world countries deliberately brought in by this administration.
Well, what's interesting is this is what wasn't even going to be the entire topic of my book. It was going to be one.
Oh, I'm sorry, we missed Ann Coulter. I'm sure she'll call back because the point she's making is so critical that, in fact, the Democratic Party is carefully designing a way of capturing more congressional districts, more electoral college votes, by peopling the states with newcomers who then quickly, as soon as they're legally eligible and probably before, are enrolled as voters. And of course, even these young children who are being brought across the southern border are being carefully placed in states where more Democratic voters are needed. We've got William on line 8. William, glad to hear from you.
I'm Ms. McCoy.
Yes.
Hello?
Glad to hear from you, William.
A very merry and blessed Christmas to you and all of you guys. I want to invite any Democrats or anybody who wants to allow folks in, any unvetted Syrians, let them come to 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue or wherever Mr. and Mrs. Clinton and their children live and Bernie. Anybody that wants to allow those folks in, let them come to their houses.
Well, that's a very good point, William. Thanks for calling and Merry Christmas. And Ann, are you back on the line now?
Yes. Yeah. Somebody hit the cough button and I got disconnected. no, but your last caller is completely right. I mean, this is what's happening to the Republican Party right now. I think we could be seeing a breakup of the Republican Party, as we saw the Republicans break away from the Whigs. And over the exact same issue, cheap labor. Rich people don't see the effects of this mass third world immigration. No, their maids are living off in the suburbs, whose public schools are being ruined, and whose girls are being, you know, gang raped by Mexicans or had, you know, the credit card theft from Albanians and Russians. I mean, the numbers of complicated financial crimes, the amount of money that's being stolen from Medicare, Medicaid, in insurance fraud scams, these aren't Native American habits. These are very unusual crimes. The gang rape and child rape is through the roof. I mean, these liberals will make up stories about UVA, the media, that is to say, UVA gang rapes. They're so dying for a fraternity gang rape.
Right.
Well, waiting to find a real one. Meanwhile, Hmong, Mexicans, Somalis, we have massive child prostitution rings and human smuggling, and if the media mentions the case at all, which is a lot of what my book goes through, how the media hides this stuff, if they do it at all, it will be, you know, Minnesota man arrested for child prostitution.
They don't say Somali. Right.
No, they certainly don't say Somali. They certainly don't say immigrants. They certainly don't say illegal immigrants. And there were some pretty shocking cases I came across. I pay attention to politics. I pay a lot of attention to crime. And, I talk to my friends about a lot of these cases who also pay attention to politics. None of us knew about these cases. No, we're too busy hearing about fake outrages, fake acts of racism by white Americans in Ferguson, by the Duke lacrosse team at UVA. The massive media and government cover-up is astonishing, but we've been so inundated. This is what the reaction to Donald Trump is about. You know, they had this documentary on Trump 1 hour last night on MSNBC, and I had talked to them from like 3 months ago. Needless to say, all I talked about was immigration. They asked me about some subsidiary issues, and at least I don't think I saw the whole thing. But every little clip they used of me had nothing to do with immigration. The entire part of the show I saw had nothing to do with immigration. It is insane. Anyone who talks about Donald Trump is lying to you if they are not explaining his appeal as based in immigration.
Well, that's clear because you can see the crowds cheering him when he says, we've got to build a wall.
Yes, yes, yes. And, the media is shocked. Don't talk about Mexican rapists. Look, the point on the criminal issue is not just that all of the facts that are available, and I'd like to have more facts available, suggest that the immigrant crime wave is enormous. It's being hidden. And we don't want any immigrants who are criminals. I mean, this is madness. We have our own criminals. We don't need more criminals. Why would any country be bringing in one person who commits a crime? And why wouldn't that person be immediately deported? Why would you bring in one person who needs government assistance? It's just madness. But it gets votes for the Democrats, and it gets lots and lots of cheap labor for the rich, and even beyond that, I just think it's reached a level of national psychosis where the elites, the ones who don't have to pay the price of all of this massive third world immigration, they have a warm feeling about themselves. They think someone who just arrived, yesterday from wherever, Bangladesh, Vietnam, Mexico, Honduras, is the equivalent of a descendant of an American slave. Well, no, we've got to stop this idea that held by every liberal and the RNC that any slightly beige person is the equivalent of an American black. The reason Americans are sensitive to race is because of slavery. It's the legacy of slavery, the legacy of Jim Crow. Yes, we owe something. There is a special relationship of black people to American society. There isn't for someone who's never set foot in this country before. We didn't do anything to you. If anything, we were out, saving you from hurricanes and tsunamis. You owe us.
Right. Now,
But immigrants get affirmative action in this country.
It's clear that Donald Trump owes you big time because so much of his campaign is verbatim from your book.
Well, he's a thank you. I think I owe him because this is why it is our only hope for America. I feel like you can't get these things discussed. Not on conservative media, most conservative media, not on obviously not in the mainstream media. I mean, this entire burden has been being carried by about, three bloggers, three radio hosts, Matt Drudge, God bless him, and one member of the United States Senate all this time, and now Dave Brat. But you bring these issues up, and they cut to a commercial. They cut your mic. The only person who could have voiced, I can't believe I'm, I feel like I'm dreaming. I wake up and see, everyone's talking about anchor babies and sanctuary cities. And by the way, you see now with Donald Trump why they won't have the debate. What is the first thing they go to? Racist, bigot, Hitler, George Wallace, fascist. That's your argument to start calling us poopy heads? Well, okay, now I see why you didn't want to have this argument. Once we're talking about sanctuary cities, once we're talking about anchor babies, there's no way they can win this argument.
Right.
But look, I tried to foist the immigration issue on at least three other Republican presidential candidates, and some at great length, some briefly. I sent a few advance copies of my books out. I never imagined Donald Trump would run. They didn't pick it up. I gave them this issue years ago. Donald Trump saw me on Jorge Ramos And before I was at the Miami airport, one of his assistants had emailed asking for an advance copy of my book, and he actually read it.
Wow.
You really have to read this book to understand what is going on now. So it isn't just, you know, by accident, but he's been good on this issue for a while. My book just gives you a lot of stuff you didn't know before.
And tell the listening audience the name of your book, because it is the playbook for Donald Trump, and it could be the playbook for the next president of the United States.
Adios, America, the left's plan to turn our country into a third world hellhole.
If you haven't read it, read it. This is Betsy McCoy standing in for Laura Ingraham. This is your healthy radio addiction.
The Laura Ingraham Show.
This is Betsy McCoy standing in for Laura Ingraham. Merry, merry, merry Christmas. This is my Christmas present to you. A special lineup today. We're just about to have Louis Gohmert from Texas on the line. And in the meantime, we've got Terry on line 7. Terry?
Yeah?
Merry Christmas. What's on your mind?
Yes, ma'am. I like Cruz more than Trump, although I do like Trump. And I want to read your book. I'm a retired correctional officer in California,
mm-hmm.
and you're right on about the criminals and the illegal aliens being criminals in our system. It's pretty frightening.
Well, it certainly is. When you were when you were in the correction system, did you have a chance to interact a lot? Did you see this firsthand, how many of the immigrants coming into the country end up in prison?
I actually had no way of knowing if they were American citizens or not. As a correctional officer, we're more with protecting the public and protecting the people that work in the prisons than we are and who or what each person has actually done to get there.
Now, why do you like Ted Cruz? I happen to like him a lot, too.
Because he's not the typical Republican.
you bet.
I voted for Nixon when 18-year-olds first could vote. I've been a Republican ever since, and I'm really disappointed with the whole Republican Party.
Well, I know that many, many listeners, and you can count me among them, shares that view. We're very disappointed with the Republican leadership in Washington. It's go along to get along. Merry Christmas, Terry, and thanks for calling. We've got Joyce on line 5.
Hi, Betsy. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you for calling. What's on your mind, Joyce?
Okay. I'm an independent. I campaigned for Mitt Romney very, very hard. And very disappointed that he didn't win because the Republicans stayed home.
Oh, you are so right.
I helped put in the Republican senators and congressmen in the Senate and in the House. And this is what we get. Paul Ryan and 150 Republicans voting for Planned Parenthood, sanctuary cities. Well, I am totally fed up. Not only am I going to vote for Trump, you know, I am not going to vote for any Republican in Congress or for Congress or for senator, only a Republican president. I am going to donate money for anybody that will run, a Republican that will run against Paul Ryan in Wisconsin. I mean, for Paul Ryan to get up there and think the American people are so stupid and say, well, you know, we're going to, in January, give a bill to the president to defund Planned Parenthood and to defund Obamacare, which is nothing because he's going to veto when we have the purse strings,
Right.
This makes me really pissed. Betsy.
Well, you know
really
something,
angry.
Joyce? Millions of Americans share your view. Thank you for calling, and Merry Christmas. We've got Greg on line two.
Hi, thanks for having
Greg,
me.
Greg, make it quick. I don't want to cut you off, but they're going to give me a hard break soon. So just tell me what you're thinking, and Merry Christmas.
Okay, I'm a retired naval aviator. The only way to fix the problem in Congress is to weed them out one at a time. I wrote my rep, Andrew Crenshaw, yesterday, told him he no longer represented me, and that I will never vote for him again, and I will do everything in my power within the system to make sure that he never gets reelected again.
Well, thank you. That's the spirit. We do have to hold them accountable one at a time. Merry Christmas, Greg. This is Betsy McCoy standing in for Laura Ingram, your healthy radio addiction. Oh, one of my favorites. This is Betsy McCoy standing in for Laura Ingram. Merry, Merry Christmas. Santa's on his way. I've got my Santa hat on, and I'm presenting a special Christmas show for you. It's my gift to you, and you can reach us at 855-40-LAURA, 855-40-LAURA, or tweet Laura at Ingram Angle, or email me at BetsyMcCoy.com. And we've got one of my favorites on the line, Congressman Louie Gohmert from Texas. Like Steve King, he's a real true blue conservative. Congressman Gohmert, thanks for calling in.
Well, thank you, Betsy. It's always good to talk to you. And you're giving a great gift to America, the radio show. But, man, we didn't give America a very good Christmas present with our omnibus bill.
Well, that's exactly why I asked you to come on. Please tell everyone why you voted against it.
Well, let me count the ways. well, I know the one thing that people point to that say this is a great thing, we're going to be allowed to export oil. But at the same time, this bill it actually puts money back in the fund for something that had died, and that was the federal government's ability to buy millions and millions of acres of land that they can put off limit to oil and gas production. We thought the program had successfully died. We're 10 billion dollars behind in repairs and just maintenance for facilities and land and things that we own right now. So we didn't need to keep buying more and more land.
Well, the federal government owns too much land, don't you think? The federal government owns
absolutely
too much land, period.
Arthur Laffer's exactly right. We need to start selling it.
It's a threat to our freedom.
More and more land.
That's right.
And then another problem, you may remember when Clinton was president, he didn't spend any money. He just named the second largest deposit of coal and all the acreage that covered it as a national monument. So presidents have used that to put minerals off limits, oil, gas, coal. I got one daughter that lives in Germany, and every week they give her a pile of coal to burn in her her stove to stay warm. But not here. You know, Clinton used that national monument thing. So we were wanting to shut that down so presidents couldn't use that as a subterfuge to put millions more acres off limits without even buying it. But, we didn't shut that down. I mean, you can just go on and on.
Well, how about increasing the... Yeah, go ahead.
If you're a big fan of subsidizing wind and solar energy, then you'll be glad to know that we have extended that 5 years so that 4 years after President Obama is out of office, he'll still be getting his program subsidized. But, I mean, if wind and solar can make it competing, if oil and gas can make it competing without subsidies, great. But it ought, we ought to be back to free market way of doing things. And this just extended this. Also, we extended the land and water conservation fund that allows them to buy more land. I mean, you just go on, and it isn't good what we did overall. It's just not.
Not to mention the huge amount of the dollar spending, $1.1 trillion,
absolutely,
the huge increase in the deficit, the funding of more refugees to come in here, more H-1B visas. I mean, it goes on, right?
Yep. And we did another 10-month extension of the EB-5 investor visa program. So basically, foreigners can buy a visa by investing $500,000 in some investment that we may not even like. That is a problem. I know it was created to help draw foreign investment into this country, but what it does is it allows anybody that has the money, whether it's a drug cartel or OPEC investor or whoever,
Iranian terrorist,
basically buy
a
visa. Yeah.
Well, let me say this on behalf of the American people, Congressman Gohmert, you are doing a public service. Congratulations on voting against this budget, because the Republicans who say we have to go along to get along really betrayed the American people with this budget, and you stood firm on principle.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that was why. Something I haven't heard anybody else talk about, but we in the House had passed riders that would stop the FCC's net neutrality provisions,
right,
but that wasn't included in the final bill. This
well, thank
disaster.
You for your representation. We're going to have you back on next week to talk about that one. And Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas. Thanks so much, Betsy. God bless you.
Thank you. Bye-bye. So this is Betsy McCoy standing in for Laura Ingraham. This is your healthy radio addiction.
The Laura Ingraham Show.
Well, you know Dasher and Dancer and...
Santa's coming. Merry Christmas. This is Betsy McCoy standing in for Laura Ingraham. And this is your special gift from me, your special Christmas present, a show full of stars. I'm so glad you've joined me. This is our last segment, and we're talking to a marvelous man, a television executive, foreign policy expert, and advocate for Israel. And that's why I asked him on, Jeff Balaban, because Israel is a special holy place for Jews and Christians alike. And he's going to tell us about his project called the Iron Dome Fund. So welcome, Jeff Balaban.
Thank you, Betsy. Great to be with you. I have never been a Christmas gift before.
Well, put on your Santa hat just for this occasion. Tell us a little bit more about what you're doing, because it seems as if the Democratic Party has turned its back on Israel.
Well, let's start with the fact that there are some Democrats who held strong, but unfortunately, they are very few and far between. It looks like the Democratic Party, in its shift leftward, and it has dramatically, has adopted a stance towards Israel that's divided into two camps. There is the moderate liberal camp, which thinks Israel is only acceptable on condition that it creates a state for the PLO, a group that's really a terrorist group, that's now the Palestinian Authority, that has no interest in Israel's survival. But if they create the state, then the Democrats will support them on the moderate side. On the far left side, on the progressive side, which is a growing constituency there, their view is Israel, simply by its existence as a Jewish state, is a criminal colonial enterprise, is racist, is apartheid, and a whole host of horribles, and therefore is beyond redemption. And so we're heading into a very serious situation here, and we need to. And the other problem we have is election after election, we're told that for the sake of bipartisanship, we shouldn't talk about the difference between the parties. But there's a great difference, and that's what Iron Dome, the Iron Dome Alliance, is here to talk about.
Do you have a website?
Well, irondomealliance.com will be up and running, please God, the first week in January. So it's down right now because we're doing major overhaul, but it will be up and new and beautiful, irondomealliance.com.
And that's where people should go if they want to support Israel and support politicians who believe in Israel and will vote for Israel.
Absolutely. You know, we've had this terrible downward slide from everyone understanding Israel to be America's great ally, to be a beacon of liberal democracy and freedom in a very difficult neighborhood. And all of a sudden, you know, among the elites in the academia and the media in Europe and in the UN, Israel's treated like it's an apartheid state, a genocidal state. It's horrendous, and it's completely standing reality and morality on its head.
Where does Hillary stand?
Well, you know, there's what she says when she's running for office, and there's what we know her history has been. So I'll give you an example. Until Hillary Clinton, and very few people know this, Hillary Clinton was the first significant American politician to ever say that the idea of a Palestinian state is a good idea. Until she said it, it was anathema to American policy. When she said it in May of 1998, the Clinton White House completely repudiated what she said, said absolutely not, that a Palestinian state would destabilize the region, which, as we see, it has done, that a Palestinian state would cause terror. It's not in the interests not only of Israel, but of Egypt or Jordan, which we see is all true. But once Hillary said it, it's been downhill. So she actually bears tremendous responsibility for creating this monster, this Frankenstein, that's causing such a rift between the world and Israel.
What about Bernie Sanders?
Well, Bernie Sanders, and many people ask me the question, I guess, just as someone who's Jewish and involved in politics, and Bernie Sanders is Jewish, but Bernie Sanders makes very clear that he's Jewish by heritage or by mistake and not by thought process or mission, and he goes out of his way to identify himself in his campaign videos as, I think it's a Polish, son of a Polish refugee, not a Jewish refugee. So Bernie Sanders is, you know, despite or maybe because he's a Jewish candidate, seems to have no love at all for a Jewish state. He seems to want to see also a, he seems to see it as a colonial imposition on the Middle East.
Of the Republican candidates for president, which ones are the most reliable friends to Israel?
Well, you know, they're first of all, it's a terrific field to choose from on this issue. It's not, they're not all exactly on the same page, but they are definitely way ahead of what we see not only on the Democratic side, but even in recent elections, even in terms of McCain and Romney, who were a little more accepting of the idea of a Palestinian state. These guys are seem to be very clear. I mean, especially Ted Cruz and Marco Rubio have made very clear their skepticism at best for the idea that we've taken a terror organization called the Palestinian Liberation Organization and turned it into a state. Trump has been less clear. He's talked about dividing Jerusalem, which is just an outrageous idea under any circumstances, and certainly wouldn't bring anything other than death and destruction to Jews and Arabs alike, and would bring the last thing it would bring is peace. So I'm not sure why he says that, and I think I think Trump would be a very tough negotiator, and therefore might be good in terms of pushing back against ridiculous Palestinian demands. But by the same token, I'm not sure that he is ideologically aligned. I just don't know. Who knows what's in his mind, whether he's ideologically aligned with the idea of there doesn't really need to be a PLO state.
We have to get your material to him.
Yeah, well, I think that's – thank you for saying that. I think that we've articulated some ideas. You know, right now, the whole discussion of Israel revolves around – in Washington, are you pro-Israel? Well, what does that mean? It's like saying, are you pro-America? It doesn't tell you anything about policy. Iron Dome Alliance is dedicated to clarity in policy. And the ultimate simple dividing point between us and the rest is we say that if you support Israel, it means you oppose American policy that is intended to force or pressure Israel to do things. You want to help Israel. You want to stand by Israel's side. You want to protect Israel, like the Iron Dome missile system protects Israel from incoming missiles. America should be protecting Israel from the UN and from the Europeans and from the Arabs that are trying to hurt it.
And that's
not
why you named
pressuring and forcing Israel.
That's why you named this organization Iron Dome, right?
Well, that's right. Iron Dome Alliance is a phenomenal project by the United States and Israel, Israeli ingenuity and American support. And it's, you know, it's the same thing that people made fun of Ronald Reagan about, you know, shooting bullets out of the sky. But we see that it works.
Right.
And that's what we're trying to do, is protect Israel from the pressures of an outside world that clearly hates the Jewish state.
And thank
what
about God AIPAC?
For America.
Tell us
what about
why.
AIPAC?
Well, AIPAC, everyone used to depend on this organization called AIPAC. Republican and Democratic politicians would kowtow to AIPAC. They'd go in bended knee to AIPAC. They'd get their funding from AIPAC. And AIPAC was supposed to be defending Israel, but it looks like it's not happening anymore.
Well, unfortunately, you know, people confuse AIPAC with Israel. AIPAC is not Israel. It's an American Jewish organization that has its own agenda. And because it's an American Jewish organization, its focus is keeping Democrats happy. So they talk about bipartisanship. And bipartisanship, we all know, is important, but you don't sacrifice your policy for it. And so what they did on the Iran deal, I mean, they just collapsed. There was absolutely no, they had no willingness to use a stick. And you can't be an effective lobby. And there is no other lobby in Washington, which calls itself a lobby, that isn't willing to say to Democrats and Republicans alike, if you don't support us, then we're going to go out of our way to make sure you're out of office. And if you do support us, then we want to keep you in office. AIPAC was very clear to the Democrats, it's okay. We, you know, if you vote for Obama's Iran deal, we are not going to count it against you. We will continue to fundraise for you. Well,
that's
created
shocking.
No incentive.
Right.
Well, it's shocking, but it's unfortunately the reality because their argument is, well, what if it's a Hillary Clinton Democratic-controlled Congress situation? And the answer is, from my perspective, well, if you've dumbed policy down to the point where they can do anything to you and you can say they're pro-Israel, then you aren't helping at all. So you have to fight on policy. And we want to see – and what's happening now is, for the sake of false equivalent bipartisanship, they've dumbed down policy to the point of nothingness.
Right.
We're saying, no, we have to stand for certain principles and make it a race to the top. Support those that support you, by the way, including Democrats who support, but also support the party that supports you and make sure they're in control.
Okay, you've really laid this out, Jeff. Iron Dome Alliance. I hope everyone will look for this website in January, and before that, look for you on television, on the radio, and in print, because you're doing God's work protecting Israel, a country that is sacred to Jews and Christians alike. Thank you so much for joining us. And now it's time to say goodbye to all my friends who have joined for these 3 hours. And to wish you all a very Merry Christmas. The stockings are hung by the chimney with care, and hopes that St. Nicholas soon will be there. Merry Christmas to all.
Kids get so excited, preparing for the day. Their letters to Santa have all been sent. The cookies have been baked. Under the Christmas tree awaits the baby child. It seems to mean so much more this year than it has in a while. 'Cause it's Christmas.